Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State, and author most recently of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. And you can learn more at Michael Mann, that's one word, Michael and M-A-N-N, michaelmann.net. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, terrencemcnally.net. Let me just say that as we continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask or two in public, staying home, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation. More than 20 years ago, today's guest co-authored a scientific paper that included a graph that tracked the temperature over the last 1,000 years. Most of the graph consisted of a flat line that suddenly shot upward so dramatically that it became known as the hockey stick. One of the most famous graphs in modern science, not that there's a great deal of competition, it showed that the 1990s had been the Northern Hemisphere's warmest decade in a millennium and that climate change was real. Most of us know about the massive PR campaigns of the fossil fuel industry to sow confusion and denial in order to forestall critical changes in our energy diet that are necessary to successfully deal with greenhouse gas emissions and ultimately climate change. Well, Michael Mann was on the receiving end of the industry's wrath and revenge. His integrity was questioned. At one point, hackers attacked a server in the climate research unit at the University of East Anglia in the UK, stole and published cherry-picked bits of emails to cast doubt on the science and the scientists involved. Mann's emails were among the headliners in what the deniers nicknamed ClimateGate. Well, Mann's work was vindicated, but the encounter led him to develop expertise not just on the science of climate, but also on the strategies and tactics of those who would postpone and disable society's efforts to deal with the existential global challenge of climate change. In his latest book, The New Climate War, Mann debunks false narratives and arms readers with a real path forward to preserving our planet. He argues that all is not lost. Our civilization can be saved, but only if we learn to recognize and defeat the latest tactics of the forces of inaction. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University with joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute. He's also director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. He's received many honors and awards that recognize not only his work as a scientist, but also as a communicator of science findings. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy, and his latest, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Welcome, Michael Mann, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. It's great to be with you.
Okay, and let me tell people that we are recording this conversation Tuesday, February 2nd. First of all, how are you? Where are you? How are you coping with the resurgent pandemic?
Thanks. We're doing okay here in central Pennsylvania. We've got about a foot of new snow on the ground right now with that storm that just came through. You know, it's an interesting time now at the beginning of a new administration, the Biden administration, where there's sort of some light at the end of the tunnel now with respect to the pandemic, if we can all just sort of make it through these next challenging few months. And of course, there's some light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the climate crisis, because there's renewed commitment on the part of this administration to actually doing something on climate.
Mm-hmm. So we got us a short-term local and we got us a long-term global. Any responses to my introduction, or does that seem about right?
It is. You know, the hockey stick, as you described it, was this graph that showed actually sort of a little bit of a cooling trend from about 1,000 years ago into the depths of what we call the Little Ice Age during the sort of 16, 17, 1800s. And then, of course, the abrupt warming of the past century. And so it does look like a hockey stick laid on its side with the upturned blade representing the warming spike of the past century, and we didn't really realize it when we began undertaking this research that that would become a symbol in the very contentious climate change debate. And as a result of that, as you've noted, I found myself at the center of that debate. But indeed, as you also alluded to, I've come to embrace that role. After all, I consider it a privilege to be in a position to talk with folks like you, other good folks who are trying to get the word out and to try to inform this conversation about what is, in fact, the greatest challenge we face as a civilization.
Michael, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we'll talk about. So can you tell us, in your own words, a bit about your path to the work that you do today? Now, we've just talked about, like, from 1999 to now, in terms of a couple of things, but sort of how you were drawn to science, to climate science, et cetera.
Yeah, and that was actually the subject of a book I published some years ago called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Sort of, I suppose, my origin story, as it were. I was, you know, a mild-mannered scientist who, you know, just preferred to be left alone in the lab, crunching numbers and doing computations. That's what I loved doing. I started out in physics and applied math. I was working on my PhD in physics at Yale University. Several years into that degree program, I'd passed all my exams, taken all my courses, and I just sort of realized that I wasn't passionate about the sorts of problems that I was being given to work on in theoretical physics. And so I had sort of a crisis of scientific identity, I suppose, and I literally opened up the catalog at Yale University to see what else was going on, what other projects were underway, other faculty at the university were using, you know, the skills that I had, the tools that I had learned, math and physics, to work on other interesting problems. And I saw that there was a professor, his name was Barry Saltzman, in the Department of Geology and Geophysics, who was indeed using physics and math to model Earth's climate system. It sounded fascinating to me. I went to talk with him. One thing led to another. I ended up doing my PhD with him in that department on sort of climate modeling and analyzing climate data. And those forays ultimately led into my postdoctoral research with Ray Bradley at the University of Massachusetts in the mid to late 1990s, where we began to piece together this puzzle of how the climate had varied in the distant past. And that's what led to the hockey stick. And as I said before, you know, it wasn't the career path I had in mind. You know, when I double majored in applied math and physics at UC Berkeley, I didn't think I was you know, setting myself up for a career at the center of the most contentious societal debate, the most fractious societal debate we've ever had. But that's ultimately where my research led me. And, you know, there are no regrets, on my part, because it has given me this amazing opportunity to try to inform this conversation.
Very good. Very good. Let's come right to this. I read the names of the titles of several of your books, and there's kind of a pathway there. It's usually focused on you and your work in climate change and the different sort of challenges to that work.
Yeah.
Why did you feel the need to write this book? How did it happen? What do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, thanks for that question. You know, my past work, as you allude to, has been about the challenges in, you know, achieving climate action. Powerful vested interests that you've alluded to, fossil fuel companies and front groups and conservative media outlets that have been doing their bidding, trying to, you know, fool the public and policymakers when it comes to the scientific evidence for climate change, to thwart any meaningful action on climate, because that would hurt their bottom line. They continue to make billions of dollars profits. Every year we remain addicted to fossil fuels, and they've done everything in their power to try to, at the very least, slow that transition from fossil fuels towards renewable energy, that necessary transition. And what I have really noted over the past few years, and a lot of my past work, you know, was really about climate change denialism. The hockey stick in the climate wars was about sort of my experiences in the center of the attack machine, I suppose. The madhouse effect with Tom Tolles, the former cartoonist for the Washington Post, sort of using Tom's satire and humor to really talk about that same story, you know, how it is that we're still encountering are attacks on the science, despite how clear the evidence has become. Well, that's sort of evolved over the last few years to a point where I think we can actually say that climate denialism is largely behind us. The fossil fuel interests that have been promoting it for decades, literally, recognize that it's just not credible anymore. You're out in California. If you live in California, if you live on the West Coast and suffered through the unprecedented fire seasons in recent years, or the Gulf Coast, which witnessed an unprecedented Atlantic hurricane season this year, the Midwest, the derecho that destroyed crops in Iowa in the spring and turned things upside down there, all of these extreme weather events that have been amplified by climate change, climate impacts are now playing out in real time, and we can see it with our own two eyes. It's very difficult for the denying talking heads to convince people that it's not happening. So they have, they haven't given up. They have way too much at stake, way too much skin in the game, literally billions and billions of dollars in fossil fuels that are still beneath the ground that they ultimately want to extract and sell. And so they haven't given up, but they've shifted their tactics because outright denial really isn't credible anymore. They've shifted to this new array of tactics. And I had noticed that because I have been on the front lines of this, war, as I call it, the climate wars. And I've seen that shift in tactics away from denial towards other sort of, arguably more insidious ways of preventing us from taking the needed action, getting us fighting with each other over our individual lifestyle choices, finger pointing, making it about individual behavior rather than the larger systemic changes that we need, the policies that we need, the regulations that we need when it comes to the fossil fuel industry. They don't want us thinking about those larger systemic changes because it'll hurt their bottom line, their profit. So instead, they would gladly have it be about us talking about our diet and our travel plans, how many children have or choose to have, and getting us arguing with each other, finger pointing, carbon shaming each other, because it deflects the whole conversation away from the needed systemic changes, and it divides us, right? Divide and conquer. And there are other fronts in this war, that this new climate war that I talk about, doomism. So these are the tactics, and I just want people to recognize them. The book is to help people recognize these tactics because these are the only obstacles in our path now. We're so close.
Ah, yes, I like that. Those last three words, we're so close, that there is, despite we're talking about a war and we're talking about a new war and we're talking about, global civilization, you are optimistic ultimately. Let me ask a question, I've got one of the, renowned climate scientist on the phone. For people, what is the relationship or the difference in definition, how they play together between climate and weather?
Yeah, so, climate, as some people have said, I think it was Mark Twain, or it's attributed to Mark Twain, it may be another apocryphal supposed Mark Twain saying that, climate is what you expect and weather is what you get. I've sometimes heard the analogy used, and I think it's a good one, that, climate is your personality and weather is your mood.
Mm.
And your personality consists of the aggregates of your moods, I suppose. And the same is true here. The climate is the aggregation of our weather. It's the overall changes in the nature of our weather.
So when people see these floods, these hurricanes, that's weather impacting them that day. And once weather started impacting people in extreme ways, they began to realize climate was changing.
That's right. I think what has happened, a big part of the shift in consciousness and really why denial has become untenable, is because people can now feel it. The impact on our day-to-day weather has become so profound that we can literally see the fingerprint of human-caused climate change in individual extreme weather events that may very well have happened, whether or not we had, you know, warmed up the planet, but weather events that have been made more extreme because of our impact on the planet, our impact on the climate. And nowhere is that more true than where I spent my sabbatical last year, the first few months of 2020 in Australia, where I witnessed that firsthand. I witnessed the devastating impacts of climate change playing out across that continent in real time in what they now refer to as the Black Summer down there, an unprecedented summer of extreme drought, heat, and of course, bushfires that blanketed the entire continent.
Wow. You're writing about a new climate war, and the new refers to the shift from as the sort of the public understanding and the public reality shifts. The war is the same war, in essence, but the tactics, the strategies have to shift as the context shifts.
That's
here's
right.
Yep. Here's what is a slightly flip question, but maybe not. Who won the old climate war? Did anyone win the old one?
Yeah, you know, nature did. I'd like to say we did, but nature did for us, right? Because we can now see climate change playing out. People can see it with their own two eyes. And so that war is over. That war has been ended. You could say we won it, but we won it because Mother Nature spoke loudly and clearly.
Last night I was thinking about this. I thought, here's my definition sort of the old war, the one in which you were attacked. The goal was to attack the science and the scientists head on. So enough doubt among enough people that the government, who's a necessary player if we're going to handle this, couldn't risk the economy on something that so many people still doubted. That it was the pressure by sowing doubt among enough people, you could keep the government from feeling it had the cover to take bold action.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The forces of denial and the forces of inaction, I call them the inactivists, and they're the fossil fuel companies who have engaged in these tactics and those promoting their agenda, realized that they didn't actually have to win the scientific argument. They just needed to divide the public along partisan lines. If you could keep one of the two major parties firmly sort of attached to the notion that climate change is a hoax, that it and that acting on it will hurt the economy, when just the opposite is true, of course. Inaction is far more costly than action at this point, and the damage that climate change is doing. But if they could convince roughly half the public, one of the two major parties, and elect politicians who would sort of carry forward that ideology that climate change is either not real or not a problem, then they could prevent the policy actions that they were seeking to forestall.
You do think about and write about some of the lessons of the pandemic. I think many people can see that what we've got here is one is an immediate, the other is sort of a long term, but they are both global. They attack the rich as well as the poor. They are beyond our control. I mean, there's things going on here.
And they hurt the poor the most, which is one of the ethical quandaries of both of these things, right? Those with the least resources.
Yes. And that what we've seen, if you can take a step back, and to some extent those who have been cultivated by the forces of denial and division may not be able to take a step back. But if you take a step back, you can see that there's been a cost to politicizing the pandemic. In some sense, that could lead to a little bit of an awakening that there's a cost to politicizing climate as well, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a point I've been making recently, that one of the lessons that the pandemic taught us was the deadliness of ideologically motivated science denial. Because in the case of coronavirus, we can measure that toll literally in hundreds of thousands of lives here in the United States. That was the toll of the campaign to deny the public health science that indicated the need for social distancing, mask wearing, et cetera, because it was disadvantageous to Donald Trump and his election prospects. And so that was ideologically motivated science denial, and it cost us hundreds of thousands of lives. And we all know people who lost their lives because of it. So it makes it very real, very immediate, very near. And I think it provides us an opportunity now to then talk about, well, climate change, it's an even greater crisis, because a year down the road, while coronavirus will be largely in our rear view mirror, although, of course, many of us have lost loved ones or people we know will suffer permanent consequences, but by and large, it'll feel like it's behind us. But the climate crisis will still be there looming large. And so I think that maybe this sets us up to have this necessary conversation about how we tackle this even greater crisis, now understanding the damage that anti-science can do when we refuse to listen to what scientists have to say, how that can truly be deadly. And I think there are other lessons, just about our fragility, that a microscopic virus can turn our world upside down. I think it sort of helps us to understand how vulnerable we are with this population of nearly 8 billion people on the planet with finite food and water and space, who rely upon this elaborate infrastructure that we've created. And anything that, you know, threatens that infrastructure threatens human civilization. I think we now have a better feel for that.
Despite the fact that there's cracks in all of this, partially fueled by dividers and deniers and so on, that there's a shared vulnerability that I think we don't often let ourselves feel. There's me, there's my family, there's my neighborhood, there's my company, there might be my church, and that's kind of my world. And that the pandemic has shown us that we all are vulnerable. I think that's another thing that might transfer to climate as well.
I agree, absolutely. There are so many lessons. There's some interesting lessons in the pandemic when it comes to the role of, you know, lifestyle versus systemic change. We've all been forced to make pretty dramatic lifestyle changes, really voluntarily, but because of the social distancing constraints. And that's going to lead, or I should say that has led. The numbers are basically in now. Carbon emissions, global carbon emissions, dropped by about 7% last year. That's really good news. That's the good news. The bad news is we've got to bring them down another 7% this year and another 7% the next year, and so on for the next decade if we're to avert a catastrophic warming of the planet, if we're to stay within our carbon budget for avoiding catastrophic warming of the planet. And that means that all of those lifestyle changes that we've made only gets us a foot in the door, because now we've got to go well beyond that. And the only way we'll be able to do that is by tackling the basic infrastructure for energy, for transportation, for agriculture, et cetera, which is still dependent substantially on the burning of fossil fuels. We need systemic changes if we are to stay on that trajectory that we've started to get on now, that'll keep warming below catastrophic levels.
Yeah, I think, by the way, what you cited is two very positive developments from this very negative circumstance. One is how I interviewed Robert Frank, the economist from Cornell, recently. Yeah. He has a book called, the name is escaping me, but it's about is using social contagion, using peer pressure and things in a positive way.
Right.
Well,
right.
He says, you know, we have made changes to our lives that we would have thought impossible, and we made them almost on a dime. And then the second lesson is, A, we can do that, and we have done that, and B, as you point out, the effects on emissions and pollution and so on by doing so, two very big lessons.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so sometimes out of tragedy comes opportunity. And I hate to say it's a silver lining, because you know, I know people with loved ones who perished from this virus. It's awful tragedy. But if we can, you know, there will be sort of a little bit of a silver lining to it if it allows us to make this needed societal transition. And I think there's the possibility that it does help us do that.
In 1999, when you published that graph and you were initially attacked, the information in media universe of that time, looking at it from today, seems almost quaint, right?
That's right.
Who could have imagined how much harder it would become to communicate and agree on the truth with the development of social media, where, as I put it, irritation-seeking algorithms prey for profit on fear, rage, and loneliness.
Yeah, no, that's right, Terrence. And, you know, it was a very different media environment. We had still had sort of basic trusted voices that we, you know, I still remember. I'm old enough to remember when I was a young child, those broadcasts from Walter Cronkite and the way he would end those news broadcasts. And that's the way it was.
Oh, my God.
You may remember that.
Yeah, you couldn't say that today, could you? There's no agreement on the way it is.
Isn't that profound? Isn't that profound? When Walter Cronkite said that, we all knew that those were the facts on this day, February 2nd, 2021. We've lost that. And that makes all of these challenges more challenging, and none more so than climate, the climate crisis, where it is the most powerful and wealthy industry on the face of the planet that has an interest in clouding the public mindset and fooling policymakers or co-opting policymakers. They have immense power and wealth to do that. And there's a new media environment in the social media world, which can be gamed by them, hijacked by them for those ends. We thought that the internet, social media, we thought they were going to be these great democratizing tools.
Right.
But as we've learned, any tool for democracy can be hijacked by those with an agenda, and that's what we've seen happen. And it's led now to, you know, I think Trumpism was a logical consequence of the direction that everything was going, and maybe, just maybe, Trumpism, the Trump presidency, was us looking into the abyss and not liking what we saw collectively.
Right. In other words, yes, there is that possibility, and we can feel it these days even. You know, it's we don't want to bank on it yet, but we can sort of feel that. Let me, sticking with this for just a second, it seems to me, I may be using the term loosely, but I think we've got a number of existential challenges, of which climate change is probably the largest, most consequential. But the pandemic, inequality, racial division, the hobbling of democracy, are all, to me, and what's interesting is that they all call, they're interrelated, they all call for understanding, cooperation, and collaboration.
Right.
And yet, we live in a system, the U.S., governed by minority rule.
Right.
Which makes everything harder. It's like that there's a finger on the scales from the start of the game.
That's right. And there's some hard-won lessons, I think, in those battles. I'd like to think that the Democrats who've now taken control of the Senate have learned some of the lessons that, you know, when it comes to the Obama presidency and the effectiveness with which a minority party, in that case the Republicans, were able to prevent any sort of progressive policy change, or at least much of what was attempted was prevented. You know, we didn't see anything close to the revolution in, you know, healthcare that we really need to see, or, you know, any of the basic inequities that we still deal with clearly persisted, because they were effective in blocking efforts by Democrats. I think Democrats have learned that lesson, and, you know, from the discussions over the last couple days as to what congressional Democrats are going to do if they can't get Republicans on board for, you know, a bipartisan sort of relief, COVID-19 relief, for example. We need bold, you know, trillions of dollars relief package to really get things going again. And if Republicans, if enough Republicans don't come across the aisle to join them, they're going to pass it through reconciliation with 50 Democrats and a tie-breaking vote from the vice president. That's not something we would have seen during the Obama years, but I think we will see it now. So those are hard-won lessons, but I think they are lessons that are being taken to heart. Yeah.
Okay, let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Michael Mann. He's Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and author most recently of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. And you can learn more at Michael Mann. That's one word, and it's Michael, and Mann is M-A-N-N, michaelmann.net. Let's go with that just a little bit longer. Your response to the Biden administration so far, and your advice to the Biden administration.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to find much fault with what they've done so far. And I give a lot of credit. Here's a shout out to, you know, the Sunrise Movement and the Youth Climate Movement, and, you know, the architects of the Green New Deal. I don't think we'll see something that looks like a Green New Deal passing this 50-50 Senate. I don't think the votes will be there, but the votes will be there for some sort of meaningful climate legislation that will complement all of the executive actions that Joe Biden is taking. And none of that would have happened if it weren't for the pressure that was brought to bear by progressives who made sure that climate issues, climate justice in particular, was a big part of the sort of Democratic agenda in this last election. And so Biden ended up campaigning on issues of climate, climate action and climate justice, has a mandate on those issues, and has already displayed an intention to, meet those obligations with the actions that he has unveiled already, the executive actions that he outlined last week, that are very broad and sweeping across the entire federal government, impact every single department, every single cabinet level nomination, the Defense Department, Treasury, Ag, not just EPA and Environmental Protection and Department of Energy, which is where sort of climate policy always in the past sort of resided. It was sort of siloed into those two departments primarily. Now climate policy is integrated across the entire federal government, and it is it's about as far as a chief executive could go towards implementing a Green New Deal without access to the legislative branch.
Let me just say, one of the things I've heard you mention also is just the up-leveling of the status of climate with the appointment of John Kerry and those sorts of things. Talk just a bit about that.
John Kerry has some real bona fides in the climate space. He helped negotiate under the Obama administration as Secretary of State, helped negotiate the bilateral agreement between the U.S. and China, the bilateral climate agreement that actually laid the groundwork for the extremely important Paris Agreement. And Kerry played an important role in negotiating the Paris Climate Agreement as well. And so he has these bona fides when it comes to working with the rest of the world, with our international partners, collaboration, engagement in global efforts, diplomacy, the use of diplomacy to bring others along. He is almost the perfect person to be leading our international climate effort, which he is as the special envoy on climate appointed by Biden. And then we've got Gina McCarthy, combining two former EPA administrators, Lisa Jackson and Gina McCarthy, sort of leading the domestic effort. And of course, with her, experience as former EPA administrator, she's got the chops to do that and to do it well. And so, that's really important, and making sure that we telegraph to the rest of the world that we are back, the United States is back, and we are ready to lead again. That's the most important thing that this administration can be doing, and they're doing that. They're signaling that, and I think that's going to bring along some other intransigent countries. Australia, I have a lot of friends down there, spent some time down there. They've had some struggles here with the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who really has also, you know, enabled fossil fuel interests, blocked meaningful climate progress. I think, you know, that the Biden administration is going to bring some pressure to bear on folks like Scott Morrison in Australia, bring some of these other intransigent actors along.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that's almost behind everything you're saying is that these ambitions, all in the right direction, have to bear fruit. And I would say have to bear fruit in the next 2 years, so that that reflexive thing that American voters seem to do, which is to, reject the party in power in the midterm elections, doesn't happen and cut everything off, which I think is one of the motivators behind some of the way you look at like what you said before about you don't see Green New Deal in a 50-50 Senate, but you see possibilities. And it seems that it's that being willing to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good may be what we need to not be not have this all reversed in 2 years.
That's exactly right. And I've used that term on several occasions in recent weeks, because what we need is, you know, these executive actions are very important. But we also need, a longer legacy when it comes to climate action from this presidency. And that does mean working with Congress to make sure that we implement policy that will, you know, that will be robust with respect to the vagaries of, you know, future presidential administrations. That we sort of use both of those tools, executive action to accomplish everything we can right now, and locking in some meaningful, long-lasting legislative policies to help get us on the road that we need to be on. I'm pretty confident that we can see that over the next couple of years. I think, again, there's some hard-won lessons when it comes to the importance of getting legislation through and not making concessions. And look, if Republicans don't come across the aisle, then we're going to have to settle for, a Democratic, climate legislation. If that's all we can get, then we need to take it. But there is the opportunity to bring along maybe some Republicans and get something bipartisan, maybe start to bring some of the good faith back into this conversation.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've seen you also point out is that you think that climate change is actually one of those issues on which this is more possible perhaps than some others. We know where the opposition is, the fossil fuel industry, and the Republican Party has, through its Koch millions and Koch brother millions and so on, has sort of linked itself with the fossil fuel industry, but independent, or at least a few Congress people and senators, know that their state needs help.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, if you're in Florida, for example, if you're a Republican in Florida, like Rob DeSantis, who has in many ways sort of towed the Trump party line, but on climate, he's actually really supported meaningful climate actions. If your people are suffering the consequences of climate change right now, it's very difficult to deny it's happening. You see some cop-outs. For example, Marco Rubio has said that, we do need to do something about climate change here. We need, to adapt, which is, of course, one way. It's soft denial. It's what I talk about in the book. It's a false solution. It's an effort to make it sound like you're, talking a good game, but in fact, you're not supporting the actions that are necessary. So there's still some ways to go. But, at least some Republicans see the writing on the wall. They know that younger Republicans, overwhelmingly under the age of 40, I believe it's something like 70% of Republicans support meaningful action on climate. And so there's a generational shift underway. We're seeing, coal undergo a death spiral, and that's largely due to market forces. The fossil fuel industry is no longer quite as powerful as it once was, and that means that it's not going to sort of have the leverage that it had in the past. It means, there's some chinks in the armor. And I think that all of that sort of comes together in, if you'll forgive the term, a perfect storm of factors that really do make it possible now to achieve meaningful action, but not without continuing to push forward. Because look, fossil fuel interests, as I outline in the book, are still using all the tools available to them to slow things down, and we need an equal and even greater force in the opposite direction. Climate advocacy on the part of the people to make sure that politicians don't give in to these tactics, these delay tactics.
Right. So, okay, let's talk about one of the key messages of the book, which is the evolution of the denial, the delay tactics, which is what I think it is. I look at sort of how an old industry, especially something as large as the fossil fuel industry, has so much power and money that it cannot ultimately stop the evolution of new industries like renewables, but it can delay and disable them, handicap them. So what are some of the new strategies and tactics given the new realities?
Yeah, I mean, so, as I sort of alluded to before, divide and conquer. Getting us to fight with each other, especially over our lifestyle choices, whether you're a vegan, whether, you fly, or, what mode of transportation, what kind of automobile you use, getting us arguing with each other because it divides us. We no longer represent a united front demanding action when we're divided in that way. And as I said before, it plays into this deflection campaign by fossil fuel interests to make it about individual lifestyle choices, about your carbon footprint, rather than the overwhelming carbon footprint, which is the fossil fuel industry. 70% of our carbon emissions are from the burning of fossil fuels, or really from the fossil fuel industry. 100 fossil fuel companies responsible for the overwhelming majority of our fossil fuel, our carbon emissions. So they want to make it about you and me rather than them. And that we have to keep our eyes on the prize. We have to make sure that they are reined in with regulations, with market mechanisms like subsidies for renewable energy and carbon pricing that level the playing field so that renewable energy can compete fairly. Getting rid of not allowing for the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure and getting rid of subsidies for fossil fuel companies. These are all things that the Biden administration has said it will do. That's important. We need the systemic change. Doomism, talked a little bit about that, right?
Well, let me just say a couple of things about the deflection strategy of making you actually. Because I think this will hit home to people. You write in the book about the crying Indian image years ago, which was another and an incredibly successful attempt to deflect to individual action. And let me just say, I recently did a series of webinars for the Harvard Alumni Association on climate change. And one of the things is five sessions. People would when they registered, they were allowed to, what question would you ask? We had different subjects, different panelists, etc. But an enormous number, I mean, maybe a third of the questions were, what can I do? What can I as an individual do? So when you feed that hunger, it's fairly satisfying. It's what people... You know, it gives people, as one thing you talk about there, it gives people a sense of agency, but it's in some sense a tangent from ultimately solving the problem.
Yeah, I think there's a fine line there that we have to walk, which is, look, a lot of these things that we can do in our everyday lives, voluntary, choices that, changing our diet, how we, our modes of transportation. There are things that we can do in our everyday lives that decrease our environmental footprint and our carbon footprint. They often save us money. They often make us healthier. They make us feel better about ourselves. They set a good example for other people. So, of course, we should do all those things. What we can't allow is for that to be framed as if it's an alternative to the other thing, the even more important thing that we can all do, which is hold our policymakers accountable. Because you and I can't provide subsidies for renewable energy. You and I can't, you know, impose carbon pricing. You and I can't provide funding for green energy infrastructure. You and I can't regulate the fossil fuel industry. These are only things that our government can do. And so we need our policymakers being accountable to us and our interests rather than just being a rubber stamp for the polluting interests. And, you know, voting is an important way of doing that. And we have voted in a government now. Elections have consequences, as they say. And because we did turn out enough, you know, progressives and people who care about climate turned out that we elected a government, in fact, both a Congress now and a president who are on the right side of the climate issue. But we have to continue to put pressure on them because there's a lot of pressure coming from the fossil fuel industry still. So, yeah, you know, individual behavioral change is important. It gives us a sense of agency. It can make a difference, but it can't be a substitute for the needed policy changes. And too often, industry has tried to make it seem like it is a substitute. That's what the Crying Indian campaign was about. Coca-Cola trying to convince us we don't need bottle bills, which would, you know, require bottles and cans to be processed, recycled and processed by them. It would have been a real solution to what is now one of the other great environmental threats that we face today, global plastic pollution. Yep. We have them to thank for that problem because they were so successful in the deflection campaign that made it entirely about individual behavior to the exclusion of the needed policies.
Right. And one of the things I would think is even if you don't say to yourself, I am pitting my individual actions against working for collective action.
Yeah.
There's only so much attention we have as human beings. It's a
That's
very
right.
precious resource.
That's right.
And if they can make you put your attention into that disagreement about personal lifestyle, you may not have enough attention left to fight for collective action.
Yeah, you know, there's actually peer-reviewed studies, psychology literature that supports that demonstrates that really is true. Too much of an emphasis on individual action can sort of crowd out emotional investment in systemic solutions.
Well, I mean, I was going on an intuition, but I'm glad to hear from the academic that it was.
It's cited in my book. There are actually studies that show that it really does seem to work that way.
Yeah. Let me ask one other question, which is, you talk about we've got to remove subsidies from fossil fuels, and people who don't know the numbers would be shocked at how much they still exist. And I'll let you tell us sort of the round numbers of that. And you say we should be subsidizing renewables and clean energy. What is the current market situation in terms of pricing?
Yeah, so, you know, there is a lot of debate right now, even within sort of the environmental progressive community about the role of carbon pricing. And there's a sense among some environmental progressives that carbon pricing will hurt frontline communities, it'll hurt the poor, the disadvantaged, minority communities. And that, you know, I try to, you know, address that in the book because it's really a myth. It's a myth that to some extent has been spread by those forces of inaction because they don't want to see a price on carbon. And hey, if they can convince progressives that it's bad, that's a huge win for them because, look, they've already got the right, side of our political spectrum, you know, on their side. If they can actually win over some progressives by convincing them that carbon pricing is not consistent with a just transition, that's a huge win. And they've been doing that. Bad actors, Russia has been interfering in our politics and politics in other countries trying to defeat carbon pricing efforts because they, you know, Russia's greatest asset, Putin's greatest asset is the fossil fuels that are still buried beneath their soil, and they want to extract and sell them. And as a result, they've been actually as a sort of a petrostate, been working in bad faith to try to prevent meaningful climate action on the international stage. And so, look, the reality is that it all depends entirely on how it's done. Where it's been imposed, where carbon pricing has actually been implemented in Australia until the Conservative government got rid of it, and in Canada under the Trudeau administration. It's actually ended up being progressive. Low-income earners have actually gained because the revenue is actually returned to the people on a progressive basis. And so carbon pricing can be done in a just way, and it's a critical tool in the toolbox. Look, it's not a panacea, but we need all the tools in the toolbox to solve this problem. And carbon pricing, in my view, is one of them.
Yeah, I will say that as I'll mention a couple of things. One, I went and I looked sort of what are they, you know, sort of did a search on arguments pro and con, carbon pricing, carbon tax, cap and trade. And the first thing I will tell you is you are absolutely right that almost every reference against them at this point is still from the right. From the Cato Institute, from you know, from the National Review. But the justice issue, the progressive versus regressive issue, and with cap and trade, there's the thing of local versus global. You cut the global total, but it's likely that the place that gets hurt will be the local poor communities.
That's a possibility.
And I think what you're saying is that the devil is in the details, but we shouldn't take it off the table by assuming it will be a bad, that it will be done badly. But one of the things is what I can't help thinking is what will the carbon lobby demand in return? Will we have to reduce regulations? Will we have to reduce clean energy subsidies? Will we, do you know what I mean? It's like that really is where it's going to come down to it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and so in the end, you know, this is something I actually tweeted about some time ago when there was sort of, I forget, there was a discussion about this and sort of progressive pushback at carbon pricing. And they said, well, look, somebody made the argument, we shouldn't do it because it's just, it's politically unpopular. So, you know, of course it's unpopular. Any meaningful, you know, climate action has been targeted by the inactivists through advertising campaigns, through the vast resources they have, attacks by the right-wing media, the Murdoch media in particular, that has essentially been sort of the PR outlet for the fossil fuel industry. And so what they always seek to do is to make any meaningful solution unpopular. So progressives will say, oh, well, you know, cap and trade is really unpopular, so we shouldn't do it. And then let's try a carbon tax. Well, you know, then they're going to attack the carbon tax. And then, all right, well, that's unpopular, so let's just do it through subsidies for renewable energy. Then they attack that. It's whack-a-mole. So the problem, as I said in this tweet a couple of years ago in response to a conversation about all this, you know, the problem isn't the prescription. It's the power of the opposition. As long as they have the power and influence that they have, they're of course going to target any meaningful action, anything that hurts their bottom line, which is the profits that they get off of our addiction to fossil fuels. We have to recognize that, grin and bear it, and just fight through. Don't be distracted. Don't be dissuaded by the pushback. Of course they're going to push back. Of course they're going to attack it. We just have to make sure that our ground forces are mobilized and that we push back with even greater force in the direction of meaningful action. And so don't give up on advocating for policies simply because you think that they're unpopular with some people. Of course they're going to be unpopular with some people. The fossil fuel industry has ensured that they will use the resources to make sure that these things are always as unpopular as they can make them. We just have to fight that fight because there's nothing, you know, nothing less than the future of this planet at stake.
Okay, let me just finally say, we didn't have enough time to deal with it here, but you do believe that sort of broad-based justice systems change point of view of something like the Green New Deal is ultimately what we need to be have a healthy relationship with our climate and our environment and each other. You believe that the whole question of is unlimited growth through extraction and disposal ultimately sustainable? Is that up for grabs at some point? The point you then make is, but climate change is so imminent that we may not be able to do either of those things this year or next year, and so we should do what we can, knowing that we need those two things ultimately.
That's exactly right. Let's work within the system that exists to get the action that we need right now, while working, of course, to change that system for the better. And so there's room for both of those things. But there really is a time scale issue here, where the climate crisis, is so urgent that we need to work within, for example, the market economy that exists today for meaningful climate action. While arguably, we do need to think about whether, an extractionist market economy is ultimately consistent, a resource-driven global economy, if that's ultimately consistent with environmental sustainability. There are some deeper questions that we need to ask and address, and I hope that we do. And I hope that we do solve many of the larger systemic problems that we still face. But this is something we've got to solve now.
Another thing you point out is that given the evidence of what happened due to the pandemic, it turns out that shows us even more that we can. Asked you to just give us the bullet points of your 4-point battle plan, not to flesh them out, just the bullet points, we'll close on that.
Okay, great, thanks. So, the plan is, first of all, let's take advantage of the moment that we're in. The youth climate movement, the social justice movement, this renewed activism, we're at this critical point. We've seen some important tipping points, good tipping points, when it comes to issues like marriage equality and now racial justice. And I think we're very close to the tipping point on climate, but we need to take advantage of the energy that exists right now in these movements. We need to listen to the voice of the children. They have recentered this issue where it always should have been about not just science and economics and politics, but about ethics, about the ethics of, preserving this planet for future generations, the ethics of, solving a problem where the worst impacts are being felt by those who had the least role in creating the problem. Educate, educate, educate. Don't necessarily debate climate change deniers. Many of them are hardened in their ways. They're driven by ideology rather than facts. And we could waste a lot of time and effort trying to convince them. In fact, they probably like nothing more than us wasting all of our time and effort trying to convince them.
That's right. There's that attention again. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's focus on what I call the persuadable middle. People who are genuinely confused or who don't think it's possible to solve the problem. They think it's just too big. A little bit of education there, providing them the tools and the information that they need to realize that we can do this and that there are things that they can do in their everyday lives to help move us along. That's really important. And then, disregarding the doomsayers, the doomism, the idea that it's too late to do anything. The irony is, of course, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we believe the doomers and we listen to them and we refuse to act now, then it will become too late to do anything about the problem.
Very good. So the new book is The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. The website is michaelmann.net. Michael Mann, M-A-N-N, all one word, .net. For this conversation and many others, interviews, articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're both the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and 8 or 10 articles of relevance, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, most podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts in a searchable form at my site. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can follow me on Twitter, @McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Michael Mann. Keep up your good work.
Oh, thank you, Terrence. It was a real pleasure talking with you.